Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio. Special operations military news and straight talk with the guys in the community. Army Ranger and Green Beret, Jack Murphy.
Good riddance. Hasta lasagna. Don't get any on ya.
Marine Scout Sniper Jason Delgado.
It's just something we believe in. I associate that with taste buds. I like freaking chocolate chip mint. Why is his flavor boring? Because his whole life is boring. But whatever.
And now, here's your co-host and producer of this operation, Ian Scotto.
StopRep.com, on time, on target. Ian Scotto here. Jason Delgado with me. Really enjoyed last episode, by the way, with Donnie O'Malley. I appreciated him getting it out on Instagram because I noticed you got a ton of new followers thanks to him. And
awesome dude, man.
I'll be honest, I didn't realize how big he was. Like, I've heard of Matt Best. I've seen his stuff. I know Matt has a huge following. I was not familiar with Donnie O'Malley, and I'm glad you made the introduction.
I mean, I'm big, like I said, big fan of all those guys. But Donnie O'Malley, to me, because I'm huge on comedy. I mean, a lot of people are. Like, I'm the huge on comedy. But whatever, you know, I'm, like, huge fans of Will Ferrell, you know, Chris Tucker. Guys, those are guys that, you know, you can, Mike Epps, you can have them go and like, in an impromptu way, they can perform an entire set. You know what I mean? These guys go off script all the time, and they provide a lot of comedic gold while they do that. And to me, I see that in Donnie O'Malley. That's talent right there. Like, he's legit funny. So that's why I thought it would have been awesome to bring him on the show. And
absolutely,
I think it was great.
And even checking out his videos, he does a great job. Like, the production value is top-notch. But I'm especially excited for tonight's guest, which is completely different than something like Donnie, with Jack Devine coming on, veteran of the CIA from the 60s all the way up to the 90s. And I mean, he's been instrumental in so many moments in American history, including the capture of Pablo Escobar, the fall of Chile's president, Iran-Contra, and the fight to push the Soviets out of Afghanistan in the late 80s. So it's like, there's so much history there, and it's always a real honor to talk to these guys. So I'm excited for it.
Yeah, definitely. Super, super intriguing guest. I mean, you know, I've never interviewed someone of this caliber, you know, within the intelligence community. This is, I mean, who else has, you know, the jacket this guy has? You know, he's got 30 plus years, you know, in the CIA. That's pretty crazy. Yeah, looking forward to see what he has to say on a lot of today's topics, you know, considering, you know, a lot of his expertise, you know, ran into basically trying to oust, you know, FBI moles and stuff like that were selling a lot of information to the Russian government. So I'm sure he has a lot to say on that. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, this is similar to, you know, guests we've had on in the past, but it's been a while. Guys like Oliver North or Bob Baer, like, those are some really big names we've had on, but those were actually a couple of years ago at this point. So it's cool to get someone else from a background like that. Big announcement to make. Jack Murphy, as you guys know, hasn't been here for the past couple of months and was very secretive about a show that he was working on. Couldn't really talk about it. Well, we can now, because I think after the Hollywood Reporter has reported on you, it's fair game to talk about. So here's the big announcement from the Hollywood Reporter. Discovery, and that's as in the Discovery Channel, investigating inventor Nikola Tesla's mysterious death in new series. The series will also feature an engineer and his team as they build and test fire one of Tesla's most dangerous inventions, a weapon of mass destruction called the Death Ray. Mm. Discovery Channel is investigating the mysterious circumstances surrounding the death of inventor Nikola Tesla amid World War II. The tentatively titled Tesla will also feature an engineer and his team as they build and test fire one of Tesla's most dangerous inventions, a weapon of mass destruction called the Death Ray. In 1943, Tesla, who has been called the man who invented the 20th century, was found dead in a hotel room. His safe was cracked open and his research was missing. In 2016, the FBI declassified 250 documents that provided new insight into Tesla's work and final days. The files revealed new information about the death ray and showed that world superpowers, including the US, Soviet Union, and Axis powers, were all interested in the weapon. In the new series, military investigator Jack Murphy and Tesla historian Cameron Prince travel the globe hunting for information about Tesla's innovations and the research that may have gone missing from his safe. The places they visit include Tesla's last standing American laboratory in Shoreham, New York, on Long Island, his first American lab in Colorado and Serbia, his homeland. Murphy and Prince interview a wide range of people, including a rare conversation with Tesla's closest living relative. They also examine never-before-seen hand-drawn sketches and calculations for the death ray that were completed by Tesla himself. Additionally, engineer Aaron Castro and his team will build a prototype of the death ray. If they can construct and operate this fatal weapon, it might provide a motive for murder. Tesla's death ray could have swung the balance of power in World War II. The world's superpowers would have been in a race to get the plans or at least keep them out of the hands of their enemies. So here's all the info. The new series debuts on Discovery at 10 p.m. East on Tuesday, January 2nd. So that's right around the corner. It will be preceded by a special airing December 22nd that highlights Tesla's work and it has contributed to communication and transportation technologies. The series also will air on Science Channel on Monday night starting January 8th. All episodes will be available on Discovery Go. And I'm really psyched for this and I'm really excited for Jack Murphy getting this opportunity. And I knew from the very beginning the show was about Tesla, but you know, when you sign these contracts with TV channels, you have to be pretty tight-lipped about it. So
sign these non-disclosure agreements, and, you know, you can only just say, oh, we're working on something pretty cool. You guys will have to just wait for a couple of months and trust me.
It's not what you would think, too. Like, the people who knew, who know Jack Murphy, they're like, Nikola Tesla, the guy who helped invent the radio? Why you? You know, you think of Jack Murphy doing, like, a special operations show, and this is not it. But it's cool. It's going to show his versatility, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And, like I said, Tesla's one of the most intriguing minds of our history, you know, right there up with Albert Einstein. I mean, he was working on a lot of innovative, and I would see why this would be such a controversy. I mean, he was working on a lot of innovations that would have helped mankind, like powerless electricity.
Yeah.
That was one of the biggest things he was working on, where he was constructing these huge towers, and out of nowhere, he would just shut down, and I guess all funding for that was pulled from him. So there's a lot of controversy surrounding his life in general for the things that he was doing, you know, as far as his progression of humanity. So
yeah, I think it's going to be great, and Jack Murphy, you know, he's been missed on the podcast. People love hearing you, but people love hearing Jack. They're used to Jack.
Yeah.
So they're like, where is this dude? And that's the reason why. So
don't worry. He'll be back guys.
He'll be back in January. Yeah, we'll go back to the month on month off thing. And I like it, man. I think you guys both bring a different flavor to the show. Before we get to emails, I was going to say that Jason correctly predicted Alabama's Senate race, that Roy Moore was going to lose. I was incorrect.
I mean, you know, you could have been blind and seen that, you know what I mean?
I credit it to you watching a lot more news than me, I guess.
And like I said, it's just...
It was very close.
But what you were asking the people of Alabama to overlook wasn't something like a sexual assault allegation. It was a child molestation allegation, you know? So... Whether it's still allegation, but whether the potential for it to be true, it's just no one wants to deal with that, you know, even if it could have been totally false and drummed up. It doesn't matter. The point is, what if it could have been true? The people they're not going to live with themselves if they, you know, I don't know how they could live with their consciences if they knew that they helped put someone like that, you know, in the Senate. So
razor thin victory, though, I think under 2%. Right. Yeah. I mean, it could have gone either way. And actually,
I think they're waiting. They're also he put a hold on confirming.
Conceding.
Yeah, exactly. So so he's waiting for the military and the overseas ballots to come in. So but 20,000 is a big number. I don't see that many coming in. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Maybe he's hopeful.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he lost fair and square. It is what it is. But you were correct. We have one quick email to get to. Really quick note before that. We have now ended our contract with mid-roll. So what that means for you guys is like a lot of the live reads we were doing, we're no longer under contract for. And we're going to be really selective about advertisers coming in the future because mid-roll is kind of an aggregate who worked with us and like I think literally hundreds of other podcasts or maybe dozens. Yeah, we decided that we're going to do that independently. What that means for you guys is less live reads. I'm sure you'll be happy about that. And we're going to bring in some really cool advertisers for 2018 of just great products, great services.
Yeah, relative content and advertising, you know?
Yeah. I think in the future, I could be incorrect here, but I know there's been talks with like Harley Davidson, maybe USAA, stuff like that, that you guys are really going to dig. Yeah, we're only going to bring in products that we're like 100% behind. Not that we weren't in the past, but it was getting a little excessive with the live reads, and we're just like, we're switching things up a bit. Really quick email before Jack Devine. I had to mention this, and I'm sure you'll like it. Interesting thing. This comes from Steve Rutledge, and I swear that name sounds very familiar.
Why do I know that guy? Oh, yeah, Steve Rutledge, man. I think we're Facebook friends, man. He's a Marine, another devil dog. Yeah.
Well, here's what he said. It's not really a question, more of a comment, but he says, gents, visited New York City and stopped in at Emmett's. Great place, and the Guinness was really good. Thanks for the tip. Loved seeing the books on the walls. Love the show. Semper Fi, he ends the note with. And yeah, if you're ever in New York City, stop by Emmett O'Looney's in the heart of Times Square. That's not a paid advertisement. We love what he does. And by the way, not to be confused with O'Looney's, because his father owns a bar. This is Emmett O'Looney's, which is actually right by Sirius XM. It's on 50th, right?
Yes. Yeah. 50th and 7th?
I believe
so. Yeah, 50th and 7th.
Yeah, so visit it. You'll see Jason's book on the wall. You'll see Brandon's book on the wall.
Tonto's. I think Drew Dwyer has his article.
His article. Leo Jenkins.
Yeah, Leo Jenkins.
Marty Scoveland. It's all, and of course, Andrew Wilkow, yeah, who really made the introduction for all of us. I know that it happened.
This is true.
Andrew was walking by that bar one day, and he was like, hey, you're Andrew Wilkow. Listen to your show all the time. And from there, we made a lot of connections.
Emmett O'Looney, bar none.
And
one of the best
patriot
establishments to be in, yeah.
Yeah. So hit it up if you get a chance. Unless you have anything else to say, I think we'll get over to Jack Devine.
Let's do it.
So joining us for the first time on the podcast, we're really excited. Jack Devine, veteran of the CIA from the 60s into the 90s, instrumental in so many moments of history around the world. And it's just so much background there, and I'm looking forward to getting into it. Founding partner of the Arkin Group, LLC, and also the author of the latest book, Good Hunting, An American Spymaster's Story. You could also check out the Arkin Group online at thearkingroup.com. And pleasure and an honor to have you on, sir.
Well, it's great to be with you.
So the first thing I'd like to get into is just your background in the CIA and how you got involved in the CIA, just the origin of that.
Well, I actually was teaching high school in Delaware County, Pennsylvania. I'd done graduate work and tracking international relations and was interested in it. But when I joined in the 67, to give you some ancient timeline. Very few people talked about CIA. It wasn't a news story. Today, every major newspaper has two people to just cover CIA. But back when I was there, it'd pop up on the screen once in a while, Bay of Pigs, and then it disappeared. I didn't know anybody in the CIA, didn't have any links into the elites or whatever of the network and CIA. And my wife gave me a book. It was called The Invisible Government, and it was, you know, an attack on the CIA. By today's standards, it would be a cream puff, you know, how they overthrew the government and controlled everything, which isn't true. But I read it, thought, wow, what an interesting line of work. So when pens had ink in them, I actually sat down and wrote a letter. There's no, you know, CIA, Washington, D.C. And lo and behold, a few months later, I had a letter saying, go to the 12th and Chestnut and meet this guy, and we'll see whether we like your look. So that's how it started. I mean, I was probably one of the least informed, least prepared people that entered CIA in its history. At least I felt that way. But in retrospect, and let me cap off so we can have more questions for sure, but you know, when I did the book and you look back on it, sometimes in life things play right for you. And I actually feel my DNA, whatever is in it, I really felt like I fit there. And I think they felt I fit as well since they didn't drive me out. But I really do feel by as serendipitous as the entry into the CIA was, you know, we all have a bit of destiny in it, and I think somehow I ended up in just the right place. Wouldn't change it. No second thoughts about my time in there, and no angst about my experiences.
That's amazing. That really is. Just considering that, you know, you were inspired through your wife from a book, and then from there just spawned off into an entire career that was as extensive as yours. Super, super amazing.
One of the problems today is it's such a structured application process. I mean, I actually talked to people in the process of going in, and I felt I was being looked at as like a small, personal thing. Today, you know, they get 100,000 applications as it goes into computers, and I think people get thrown out that are probably really good candidates, never get the first shot because it's, you know, your computer numbers didn't add up. So it's a fact. It's a factor of the time we live in. But I really feel we, and circumstances, it's not anything that can be rolled back. I feel today that it's really hard for people to break through the door, and it's a shame. Numbers don't tell the whole story.
Well, that's amazing. So, coming up in the CIA, I'm sure initially you have a bunch of lackluster, you know, jobs or responsibilities. I think I read you were an analyst or document analyst or something like that.
Yeah.
Initially. And what was your first actual assignment that you were physically on the ground where you had to, you know, work contacts and, you know, recruit sources and stuff like that? Like, what was the first time you ever did that?
So, I joined the agency by the time I got through training, which is almost a year, and then Spanish language, and then I did what you would call interim assignments on the check desk and a couple other rotations. But I ended up in Latin America, which is kind of an interesting story. I want to go back. I do so little that I thought when we were coming out of the career training program, out of the famous farm, and you decide where you want to go. I thought, well, I should go to Russia. That's where the communists are. And so everyone had a career counselor. So I went to this fellow. Your audience can't see this, but I'm 6'5". I don't really fit the visual profile of this guy.
You stand out everywhere.
So the guy that was interviewing me, he was in the Bay of Pigs, and his name is Jerry Droller, and he actually was a veteran of World War II and worked with the resistance in France behind the lines against the Nazis and organized the resistance. Tough guy, you know, smoked, had a cigar hanging out of his mouth all the time. And he said, "Oh no, no, you're too tall. You can't go to Russia and be a spy." And I thought, well, yeah, I guess he's right. So he walked me over to the Latin America division, and I ended up in the Latin America division. I thought, wait a minute. How am I too tall for Russia, but somehow 6'5", I fit in Latin America, you know?
I bet you.
But I think he was a recruiter for Latin America, so he was looking for warm bodies. But I come back to this hidden hand in people's careers. I mean, in Russia back in those days, it was sort of dull because they were all over you all the time, so it wasn't meeting, recruiting, and action. It was spending days finding 30 seconds where you could drop a rock with a note in it for some spy.
Wow.
In my case, I ended up in Chile, and for those of your members of your audience that either study Latin American history or history in general or were around in those days, I went to Chile in 71 when President Salvador Allende had been elected, and the White House in the form of Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon saw him as the next Castro, and that, you know, he came in and power. He came into power in a coalition that included communists. So they referred to it as a red sandwich: the Chile and one end, and Cuba on the other. And they, you know, decided that they want to block the government. They wanted to overthrow it. The CIA said that not going to work. There's not enough time between the election and his inauguration. They said, give it a try. This is documented, by the way. Mm-hmm. You won't catch a secret today. I'm giving you context, and I'm sharing with you things.
Nice.
That,
we appreciate
but
it.
This is all documented. They spent a year mm-hmm. investigating this thing. But what happened, it didn't work out, and then the CIA was instructed not to overthrow him, but to do everything it could to make life difficult and protect the democratic institutions, and that was sort of my job. But as time went by, IND of its own weight, its terrible policy, very similar to Venezuela today. It's almost a mirror image of how Maduro is handling the situation there. And in the end, its economic policies really drove it to the brink. And to make a long story short, IND was overthrown. And it was my agent who had the first report, but not to diminish myself. I was out at lunch developing, you know, some contacts, and my agent couldn't find me, and he was going to go to the airport and get out of town. So he found my wife, Pat. So she actually was the first person to get information in American and official format that the government was going to be overthrown. So you can see in the files and the public record, there's a cable that I sent in based on Pat's meeting with this fellow, saying that the Navy will start and Radio Agricultura will come on at 7, and Allende's going to be overthrown. And it was sent as a critic message for those that aren't familiar with it. When you send a priority or immediate flash, but then you get the critic, it just rides over all communications. No one gets a chance to filter it. So it went from the hands of the chief of station in Santiago right into the White House, saying that the coup was going to come the next day. So that was my first assignment. And I think the extraordinary thing, and again, I don't want to harp on my naivete, but, you know, I lived in parochial Delaware County, and next thing you know, I'm sitting in a country, my first day there, there's 100,000 communists marching on the street with flags, and, you know, they threw a bomb at the house next to me, missed, blew off the back of the house. I mean, it was like, wait, what happened to
where am I?
My summers down at Ocean City, New Jersey? You know, so it was rather exciting, rather dramatic, very painful for the Chilean population, because they went from the far left extremes, and then they, you know, when they ended up with Pinochet, they had a very repressive government for years. So, and prior to that, they had a long history, I think 150 years of democratic government. So for the average Chilean, it was a really tough two decades. So, but as a foreigner, being there and being in the middle of the political fray and meeting with some of the most important movers or shakers on both sides, because I had agents that were in the Communist Party, but I also had players that were very well tied into the establishment there. So it was really quite interesting.
Did you work a lot of contacts that had that fluidity between, because it was communist, I would imagine, that fluidity between what was happening in South America, that what you were dealing with, and what transitioned later on to the Mujahideen being supported to fight Russia and stuff like that? Was that an effortless transition for you, or was it something that you had to just pick up and start all over again?
Well, for your audience, there was a huge gap. I left Chile in September of 74. And then I spent 5 assignments abroad, three of them as chief of station in Latin America. And then in mid-career, so what I'm saying, there's a lot of time between me and the Mujahideen. Mm-hmm. And then I decided I wanted to change area. In other words, I didn't want to become just a Latin American specialist at that point. Mm. And this is a long story, but I was uncomfortable with our program in Central America, not because I didn't want to resist the Sandinistas. My view is we should have been inside, and there are some of my friends thought they should be organizing the Contras on the outside. Mm. And look, you know, people are entitled to their view. But I voted with my feet, and I decided, well, I'll go to the Middle East. That'll be a new place. So instead of leaving the frying pan into a cushy job, I ended up leaving Latin America and became the chief of the Iranian branch. And for those who track Middle Eastern history, in the 85-86 period, we had the disastrous Iran-Contra affair. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
Which I was thrown in the middle of that. And again, we could spend hours talking on it. I thought it was the idea of trading hostages for missiles was ill-founded. I understand why it happened. Again, this might be of interest to your readers, but I mean to your listeners, but
sure, we both,
there was a CIA chief in Beirut named William Buckley, a first-class guy. And it was a very dangerous place, Beirut in those days. Mm-hmm. And he was kidnapped at the time and tortured and killed. But what people don't realize, there were videos of that. They were sent back to CIA headquarters. And the director at the time was Bill Casey. And he would take them down. And he and President Reagan would look at these horrible things and just felt... They didn't know he was dead yet. He would just have to do everything to get Buckley and the other hostages out. So I think they were well-intentioned, but the problem once you start dealing with hostages and trading, then, and this is what actually happened in the Iran-Contra case, they released three and then they kidnapped three more. So, you know, it's a vicious circle. So the trading was, I thought, bad policy, but, you know, people get elected as president, mm-hmm. they can make bad policy. It's the Americans' decision. They put them in. They decide. It's not CIA's job to do policy. Mm-hmm. So if that's what they wanted to do. But the guy that brought the deal together was an Iranian named Kobani Far. And we had a file at least 2 inches thick of how bad he was and how much of a fabricator and that he failed 2 polygraphs. So they had... The person putting together had no confidence in either. And I was still junior. I was probably somewhere in the range of a lieutenant colonel in those days in the system. And I thought, oh, well, you know, this is so bad it'll never happen. Well, you know, they came to me at a certain point and said, look, we know you don't like this, but can you organize the flights and the missiles and all of this? So I did. Mm-hmm. But I thought, you know, this is such a bad idea. It's never going to happen anyway. So I learned a really... important lesson, and there was Secretary of State Shultz who once said, no bad idea dies in Washington. And he's absolutely right. So this thing didn't die of natural consequences. So when I would brief agency officers going overseas to take command of post, I would say, if you see a dumb idea, you know, you drive a spike through its heart, you can't hope that it dies. Long story short on this, the problem evolved when I was charging, and I'm just giving you theoretical numbers because I think you're still classified, but $1 million for one of the missiles, but the Iranians were paying $2 million, and not known to me, the other million was being mm-hmm. funneled back into the Contras in Central America. Mm-hmm. Somebody thought that was a brilliant idea. And leaving the idea aside, the Congress the year before had said no money. No U.S. money can go to supporting the Contras. So this was a violation of law. Mm-hmm. That became the problem for the Reagan administration, almost brought it down. And they had all the famous trials, and CIA people were put on trial, and Ali North, and it became, you know, bigger. I would say it's even bigger than, well, it didn't bring down Reagan in the end. It did bring, Watergate did bring down Nixon, but it was mm-hmm. almost as big and damaging. So, when I left that, I guess they decided that maybe I had called a few things right, and they put me in charge of the task force to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan. So that is the long arc of how I got from Chile to dealing with the Mujahideen.
Out of curiosity, I'm just wondering now if you saw that latest Tom Cruise action flick. Because I saw it, I thought it was good, but I mean... You would know better than anyone if it was historically accurate.
Well, I didn't see it, but it'd be the first movie that I've seen that's historically accurate. I mean, Charlie Wilson's War, I knew Charlie and traveled with Charlie, and you know, a tremendous patriot and a guy who did great service, but it wasn't his war. And he and I had dinner at Sparks Restaurant with our wives here in New York. And
Sparks is a very good restaurant.
Well, that's where Paul Castellano, the mafia don, got killed. So this appealed to Charlie's sense of romance. We're going to eat where mafia don was killed. So when I came in, we sat down, and he said, "Jack, I know you didn't like the book. You're going to hate the movie." Well, because he knew what I knew, and that was, a congressman and a rogue CIA guy do not change history. I mean, I don't care who they are. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have a regime change, it's a big government program with a lot of government people working together, you know, sergeants, GS-12s, mm-hmm. people in logistics. I mean, it's it's not a one person's war. But Charlie was such a wonderful public relations guy. It's really quite a feat to have a war named after you, particularly if it wasn't your war. The Stinger, which was a history changing to me, one of those points in history. And there are relatively few of them where you can say a single weapon system changed the course of history.
Yeah.
Charlie, if you read the book carefully, said, "I had nothing to do with it." But in his office, he had an expended Stinger tube and hanging. And, you know, in the movie, it's, you know, him. But that's not what happened. So I didn't see the Tom Hanks movie.
Or Tom Cruise. But
Tom Cruise, I'm sorry. I was thinking of Tom Hanks because he played Charlie Wilson.
Sure.
So I don't know. I'll have to go see. What's the theme of it? What war? Oh, it's the Central America war.
Yeah, right? It's the Iran-Contra stuff. And
yeah, but I think it deals only with the one aspect of it. And
sure. Yeah, I mean, it's an action movie. Primarily you saw it, right, Jason?
Yeah, I think it was, aside from that one aspect, which we were talking about, drug smuggling.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It was, you know, they also highlighted a lot about, you know, the money transfer, the money moving, and a bunch of things. Weapon caches, or flying the Contras to training grounds in the U.S., stuff like that.
I just always like to hear from the people who were there. Was it accurate?
Let me jump in on that. Sure. I used to be the drugs are... for the CIA and chief of counter-narcotics when Escobar met his demise. But I'm on this one point, movie aside, I know because I've had a friend tell me about the movie. It's very controversial, but the planes that were, the CIA was not bringing drugs. You know, I'm saying this emphatically with not any hesitation or any qualification, was not flying drugs into the United States. I mean, this became a really hot button issue. There was an article in San Jose Mercury, you know, all about this, and then eventually the journalist was fired because the story turned out to be false, but it lingered and lingered. I think the issue might be, first part I'm positive of, but what might have been, it's the same planes that were used to move weapons may have been used by independently of the U.S. government and the CIA. Also was used, you know, drug running planes, but so it's a mistake to loop them together. And I don't want anybody audience or any audience thinking for a minute that the CIA, would engage in those activities. One of the things that people don't understand is just how regulated the CIA is, and how legalistic it is. I mean, I had a lawyer, I'm not exaggerating, 20 feet from me for the last 15 years of my career. It wasn't because I was particularly dangerous. Other people in similar jobs had lawyers. But, you know, the agency may break laws across the around the world, but they're the laws that are authorized by the U.S., the Attorney General and the Justice Department. U.S. laws are dealt with, you know, I can't tell you how judiciously. So the idea that this could happen is far-fetched. I don't think that storyline is very helpful, and it continues the myth of the rogue CIA. And I would tell you the only rogue part in my 32 years, plus the extensive reading I've done in writing books and so on, is that one point of the Iran-Contra affair, there were CIA people that worked off the books, not the leader, you know, it wasn't the CIA as an institution, but some folks worked off the books. It's the only point in my experience, and I was responsible for all of the agency's operations back in the late 90s. So I had visibility. So the idea of the CIA as a rogue entity is one of the Hollywood myths.
Mm. Yeah, I think in the Tom Cruise movie, to be fair, they did depict what you just said, that it was of his own doing. The CIA actually hired him to take photos of areas, I think they were saying, in the plane.
Well, that's more credible then. That's a more credible story.
And he, on his own, decided, well, he got balled up. He got balled up down in South America, and I guess he was saying he was forced to make a delivery or two, and then just got into it from there.
Well, maybe I'll go see it now that you've clarified that, because some of this is painful to watch. I mean, I don't like, it took years to go watch a James Bond movie. I sat beside Sean Connery one night. That's another story. But,
nice.
But somewhere along the line, I finally, the light bulb went off and said, why are you complaining? Look at you. Look in the mirror. And people think that people look like James the Sean Connery, I mean, you know, and that they're all omnipotent, you know. So, you know, with all your flaws, sure, you want to be portrayed. It's why are you fighting this? And it's true. When you get around to the bottom line, most of the, you know, the James Bond movies, at the end, it's, you know, some British guy going out patriotically trying to destroy the enemy, and they have, you know, it's all the Hollywoodization of it. But the bottom line is probably not too far off. So I decided that, you know, actually the mystique that's created by Hollywood, it can be very helpful, because many of the foreigners that I dealt with actually thought that, you know, I could leap buildings in a single bound. The more they got to know me, the more they realized that wasn't true.
I think it was American Made is the name of the movie. Yeah. And it was the story of the pilot Barry Seal. And they got into how he was independently doing his own thing on the side, you know, and working for the CIA. And he used his protection from the CIA to get away with some of the crap he was doing. So that's what it was. But they totally depicted that in the movie. Yeah,
that's a credible line. But I would just tell you, and this is not critiquing anyone in particular, but part of tradecraft, part of the experience of running operations, is that when you have an agent, you have to be constantly vetting that agent so that you're sure, you know, that he's not working both sides of the street. In other words, reporting you, he's writing, reporting to the Cubans. In other words, there is a counterintelligence dimension to all operations. Now, it's not perfect, okay? But I would just say to you that part of the tradecraft, the professional way that cases should be approached, is, and when you're working with foreign governments, for example, you're giving them money, you're working with them, often it's very useful to have a unilateral, somebody that no one knows is working for you, keeping an eye on them to make sure the weapons are going where they're supposed to be going and the telephone taps aren't being used on local politicians instead of terrorists, you know. So there is a counterintelligence piece, and I'm not saying whether the story's true or not, but it sounds like more work should have been done on that.
I agree with that. I think that would be a good segue into your experience with, from what I read, your experience with FBI moles and, you know, building cases or going after them. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, we talked at the very beginning of my career when I was, pushing paper around, waiting to get into the program, and I'm not exaggerating when I say 7 feet from me sat Rick Ames. Mm-hmm. Rick Ames, for your audience, was the CIA official who, during his career, became a Russian expert and handled some of the most sensitive cases. And then relatively late in his career, he became a traitor and walked into the Russian embassy, and we could talk about this in more detail, walked in and volunteered his services. And in the process of offering his services, he coughed up the names of 11 of our agents inside the Kremlin and the Soviet infrastructure, and all 11 were executed. Now, I knew Rick personally, went to his wedding, and it is it's one of those great agonies in life to know personally someone you would consider quote-unquote a friend of, or at least be friendly with, that they betrayed their country. So that was the CIA case that you know, it was very disturbing to all of us. The FBI case, when Rick was arrested and put in jail, by that point I was at the, I think, the number two position at the CIA, and not the CIA, but in the operational directorate. And at that time, we knew that Ames, we had lost more agents than Ames could know about, so that there had to be another mole. And that is a nightmare in and of itself. And some of the people in the agency started wearing buttons, never again. And it was, you know, it's absurd because we're recruiting people in their system, they're recruiting in ours. Mm-hmm. It's part of the painful territory. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, I knew that never again was very unrealistic because we knew there was a mole. So I worked with the FBI. We had a number of officers working inside the CIA. We started a major manhunt for that mole. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a lot of leads. And it's, again, I could go into the mechanics of this at some length. But I left, and that was in, I think, December of 99. And when I think back of my career, you say, well, what didn't you get done? I mean, obviously a lot of things you can think of, but we say, well, what was important? I didn't find that mole. So you leave and you feel mission completed, mm-hmm. but, you know, you hope somebody follows on. Well, in 2004, turns out the mole wasn't in CIA after all. He was in FBI, and he was in their Russia group, and I'll let the FBI explain why they didn't go hunting there. But and he worked for, I think, from the late 70s, off and on. Mm-hmm. Very long story. There's a good movie. I think it's Betrayal, where I can't remember if it's Charles Cooper. I think Cooper is his last. Brad Cooper. No, I'm not going to go there. But a great actor plays Robert Hansen, this FBI guy. And they started, you know, we got a tip from a source that he was in the FBI. And then, as fate would have it, a KGB guy defected, and he brought Hansen's file, but it didn't have his name in the file, but it had a trash bag that Hansen had provided documents in, which had his fingerprints on it. And it had a audio tape. There was one phone call he made to the KGB, and they recorded it, not the FBI. So when the file was produced, the very senior people at the FBI sat there and listened to the audio tape and immediately recognized it was Robert Hansen. But he was responsible for the death of another set of very good sources. It was a very bad period in the counterintelligence field, in the sense that, you know, human sources betrayed some of our most important agents, and with devastating impact. Mm-hmm.
The same with, you know, Edward Snowden, you know, and all these contractors, all these analysts and stuff like that. They think, you know, potentially what they're doing is not going to have those consequences, but they do. I mean, you're talking about quite a few people getting killed over this outing.
The difference in the post 9/11 period, if you remember, there was an expression, connect the dots. Mm-hmm. I never liked the idea but it's catchy. I mean, everyone immediately gets connecting dots, you know. So the problem with connecting the dots, you have to have good dots to start with, which is one task. But the other thing is, you start connecting dots, you increase your vulnerability when you have a compromise. So the world we live in today with the high technology, I mean, if Ames or Hansen were sitting in CIA in this age of, you know, computers and centralization of data, I mean, they might have been able to take every agent in the building mm-hmm. now. So Snowden was sitting at a hub. He was, and what's interesting about Snowden is there's similarities with some of the top traders and personality traits, and I'll go there in a second. Mm-hmm. But he was sitting there as a very junior person, I think a GS-12, you know, for the non-government types that might be listening. I mean, that would be like a lieutenant in the military, right? Mm-hmm. And so he was there as a technical job, But everything happened to be going through him. He downloaded. He had no idea how much he downloaded. It was, you know, he knew some of it was good. And the interesting thing about him is, and this is, I'll make a description of traders in general. One of the common traits among them is that they have a very big ego. They think they're very smart, smarter than everybody else. And they're narcissistic in that sense. But what they, and some of them are actually quite smart, but the other trait they have is they have personality flaws and underperform. They're lazy. I mean, intellectually lazy. In other words, I'll do A because I like A, but I'm not going to do B. So their school records aren't particularly good. They always are underperforming. Well, when you join the government, you join the military, if you're an underperformer, your career will go forward, but at a slower rate. So when you get further into your career, there's a big gap between where you are and where your peer group is. And so in the case of Rick Ames or Snowden, you know, they were moving at a very slow rate. And most people, really, their defection is based not so much on some political issue, but the fact that their career, and they blame the career not on their underperformance and laziness, they blame it on the system. Sure. So I think in some degree you see that. Now, I don't believe that Snowden was an agent at the beginning. I think, you know, he had these sets of dysfunctionality and romanticism and wanted to get even with the system. But once you travel and take refuge in the Soviet Union, your food, who you meet, your job, everything about you, you're totally in a system that is, controls your entire life. You are no longer free. So your behavior, you might as well be an agent of influence because you can only do things that are consistent. So whether he was an agent at the beginning is a very good academic thing to sort out. At some point, the Russians would have been extraordinarily lucky if they had found Snowden and recruited him. So I don't believe that's the case, but I do believe today he's under their influence, and I would just say that he's a puppet of the intelligence system. So I know that all those that are believe that the internet ought to be open and free and and totally transparent and find him heroic, I would just say he did tremendous billions of dollars of damage and put lives at risk. And I don't think it was for a superior cause. I think it was for personal interest.
I definitely agree. I don't know. I also accredit a lot of the unstable political atmosphere that we're dealing with right now has a lot to do with that distrust that, you know, that was outed along with his, you know, his disclosures. You know, one thing that you brought up, aside from all this gloominess we're talking about, I thought was interesting. I kind of hopefully you'll be able to elaborate on it, because you had a really long career in a very tough industry. And it sounded like to me your wife was extremely supportive of you every step of the way, even to the introduction of the industry or the field. And then you said also in Chile, you said she received the news of the president as well, right? So I assume she was there with you and working with you, you know, like, you know, just helping you out. You know, was that the case? And can you elaborate on this? A lot of people that long careers that their wives, you know, are kind of at home.
I think that's a great subject, and hopefully it'll be uplifting. I wasn't trying to have a downer there, because I think there's two ways of looking at this. I mean, if you look at the Ames case, what it does tell the American people is we were doing our work. There were a dozen people that we had it strategically placed. So, being traders, but it's part of the business. But we also, you know, the high note in the context of this is we did get the Russians out of Afghanistan. So let me not leave that part of the story in gloom and doom, because I actually spent most of my life in CIA in a very optimistic frame of mind. But coming to my wife, Pat, and I don't know, I hope some of your audience understands this. I think I would describe myself as sort of like a wallflower, you know, when we first started dating. And Pat's very effervescent and outgoing. So when we would go to cocktail parties, again, you wonder how I got into CIA. we first started going out to the cocktail parties, and we'd be meeting Russians and Cubans or whatever, or locals in the government. We'd go around the party, and Pat would be, Jack, you come over here, give this guy your card. You know? Well, by the way, we'd like to have you come to coffee. So she was the spark plug of interpersonal relationships. Now, I would like to think over time, you know, I learned things, and I think I got better at it and hope we're smoother in my interrelationship, but I really got a push there. And she was extremely supportive because it's one of these things. Well, what do you do today, dear? I can't tell you what I did today.
Sure.
Where are you going tonight? Well, you know, I'd like to tell you, but it's, you know, so it's, you have to have a very supportive wife. And what your audience may not be aware of, early in our career, we had 5 children, and then late in our career, we had 1 more. So we have a clan of 6 kids, and now I just had another grandchild, and this is number 14. We are a moving clan. So, but I want to tell you just one story about it, which I find fascinating. So I described how tense the situation was getting in Chile, and you could feel the country falling apart. And I was concerned that I'd be trapped in the embassy. She'd be home with the kids. So one Sunday afternoon, I said, listen, Pat, in a case of emergency, you know, what I'm going to do is let's put this sofa. We'll slide this sofa over here. Now, you kneel down. Now, here's a sawed-off shotgun now. You pointed the door, but don't aim at the head because you're likely to miss. Mm-hmm. You got to aim at the chest. So she said, well, how do you reload this thing? So if you think about it, I mean, these are young people. This is where you're like the frog in the boiling water, you know, the frog's in. You don't realize it's so dangerous, and you think you're inevitable. I needed to have my head examined that I didn't get my family out of there, but somehow you think it's not going to go. But Pat undauntingly says, sure, look, you're not here. I'll be here. I'm going to protect my clan, and I'm going to shoot it out when these guys coming through the door.
So, yeah.
And what happened is exactly, well, what happened is because I knew the coup was coming, I was in the embassy with the chief. We knew it was coming next morning. I was locked in the embassy for 5 days. Mm-hmm. Pat was stuck in the house, and we knew they were going to raid. I won't go into how we knew that raid the houses in the neighborhood. And one of my colleagues in the agency, I was able to reach him. He hustled over and threw the dog and the 5 kids and Pat. They ended up in his house for a week. So she's one very tough lady, very smart, but the other operative word is, supportive. And, they used to say behind every great man, but I would say today behind every spouse, behind every successful person, and my success is little s, but whatever I was able to accomplish was, I don't imagine I could have gotten it done without the unique personality of Pat.
That's cool, and that's all about, like, rising to the occasion. Getting back to, you know, we were talking about...
She's a better shot, I would very...
Nice.
So I have to tread carefully with her.
Getting back to the Iran-Contra stuff, but focusing now more on today, before we brought you on, Jason and I were watching this Nikki Haley speech about what's going on with the Iran nuclear deal, and kind of the fear of where their nuclear program is, which is pretty far along compared to what a lot of people thought. I wanted to hear your take on the Iran nuclear deal and Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think it's important to keep it side by side with North Korea as we think mm-hmm. about things. So in the case of the Iran deal, I wasn't happy with it, okay? I thought it was soft in places. There should have been a tougher negotiating. I think it should have been a tougher negotiation, and that we wanted it so much and relayed that we wanted so much, and Iranians are great negotiators. However, the fact that we were able to stall the program, I didn't give it an F. You know, most people, either it's an F or an A. You know, there's no in the middle. So I said, look, it's a C. It slowed down the program. You know, they don't have a nuclear weapon. It gives you time to work other things. And you need a regime change. And how do you get a regime change? Well, lifting some of the sanctions actually over time, I believe, allows more democratically focused, that may not be the right word, but people that want a more open society there needs and pressures to build within the system. So today it looks like a better deal to me. But right from the beginning, you know, it won't take them a year. I think a year would be not unrealistic until they're able to produce the first bomb. Now, look at North Korea, the speed with which they're moving.
Yeah.
If we could cut it to the same deal, you know, a C deal, and we could stop the forward movement, okay. Both places need a regime change. And I'm not talking about going in and overthrowing them, you know, with James Bond. I'm just saying that both of those places, you really don't solve the problem until you have a regime change. And these things take time, lots of time. And consequently, we need some sort of arrangement in North Korea that slows down the process. So I understand the shortcomings of the Iran deal. I said a certain aspect of it I found particularly distasteful. But it served a purpose. And I think people today in this world we live in, you know, you're either on one side or the other. It's very difficult to get, you know, some balance where you can look at some of the good and bad. I put a newsletter out quarterly, and I have a lot of fun doing it, and with the help of my staff. But I find it fascinating, and I feel like I'm doing something right, because half the people think I'm too soft on the administration. The other group feels I'm being way too hard on them.
Yeah, that is truly when you know you're doing something well, because we experience the same thing at SoftRep. I feel like people say, oh, you guys love Trump, and then other times they'll be like, oh, you guys are too tough on Trump. So
you're doing the right. I mean, look, I think part, and you know, CIA, when you walk through the door, I mean, they always show the stars, which are the heart and blood of and soul of the people that have died carrying out the mission. But the other side is a very important mantra for the organization. It's a quote from the Bible. Doubt that you could get it chiseled in the wall today, but back then, the quote from the Bible said, you shall know the truth, and it will set you free. That's all that's on that wall. And that's CIA's mission. Some very smart group of people defined this mission. Just give us the facts. Don't put any spin on it. Your job here is to get the facts, and you will, you know, that you will be completing your mission. So the CIA can't be pro-Trump, anti-Trump, liberal, conservative, and has to look like America, and its job has to be to have developed people to think independently and can properly weigh things and try and get balance and remain unpoliticized. It's not an easy task, but the tradition of the agency is in there. I couldn't tell you the political affiliation. I could guess at people in the office, because it was unprofessional to look at any of the problems that we were facing from a domestic political point of view.
Well, what you're saying segues right into what I wanted to ask you about. You earlier in the interview, you said that it's not the CIA's job to create policy. And I feel like now more than ever, the CIA has become so politicized, with people in favor of the CIA or people anti-CIA, a big split between Democrats and Republicans. And you see all the stuff with James Comey. What do you think about the polarization and the politicization of the CIA now in 2017 going into 2018?
There's a macro issue, and that is our society is much more politicized than in my adult life. But there are differences among, you know, when one looks at the military, the FBI or CIA. Now, the FBI is going through I think it's going to be a very challenging period because of this investigation. It's getting very... an ex-FBI guy or even a gal or guy in it today, I'd be worried about the image of the institution. When you get the CIA, which I want to talk to that with a much better sense of confidence of what I think we're looking at. I believe that during my time, and it continues today, most of the people in CIA join CIA for mission purposes. They do their job, they go in, they carry it, and they remain loyal to, I'm going to produce the best product I can that tells the story the way it is. The institutions itself has become a political, over the years, has at different times been subject to political pressures externally, you know, whether it was the Chile crisis, the Church Commission, the Iran-Contra affair. But, I mean, at different points, it as an institution becomes critical. But inside, I believe the institution is largely apolitical. One of the things I always felt bad about my partners in State Department is that in State Department, hundreds of political employees come in every time there's a change to the top jobs. Many of the ambassadorships go to political favors. It's amazing that the State Department is able to maintain its core, and I believe it has with that. The CIA, when the director comes out, it's very unusual that they come out with anything more than the general counsel and maybe two assistants. In other words, the chief of Latin America, the chief of analysis for Russia, these are all career people. So the place is a career-oriented place, and it frowns on internally anybody being politicized. I will say that in the last few terms, I really think we would be better served if the CIA directors were less public and not taking public positions. In fact, I would go as far as say I think we better be served if the CIA was run by a career professional and we cease and desist from bringing external politically focused people into the agency. And I think that's true with the FBI. Same thing. I think these are institutions that I think are better served by people that their career is focused on the institution and not on political parties. So it's not a common expression, and probably we were talking about down in the cafeteria when I was at GS-12. So I do think in this politicized world, political leaderships of these institutions do bring more lightning to them. But inside, I think the good news for our listeners is that inside, you know, shoulder to shoulder, the people in there, I think, remain focused on serving their country and doing the best job they can.
Well said. I was going to ask you, tell us about your book, Good Hunting, An American Spymaster's Story. I'm sure a lot of people in the audience are going to want to pick it up.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Again, I feel like the tumbleweed. You know, I'm now going to tell you how I accidentally got into writing a book. I mean, the first time, when I left the agency, they had to lift my cover because at a certain point, you're a public figure, so therefore, you do damage by not saying the guy's a CIA guy. So at a certain point, I was public. But still, when I came out into the private sector, and I run a private sector intelligence company, but when I came out, I mean, people asked me what I did. So, I worked in U.S. government. You know, I didn't talk about what I did. So I went to my dentist, Dan Heifetz, and chipped a tooth, and you know, he was a persistent guy. He said, "Well, what do you do?" I said, "I have a little company." And then he said, "Well, what did you do before?" I said, "I worked for the U.S. government." He said, "No, what did you really do?" And I said, "Well, I mean, what the hell?" I said, "Okay, I worked at CIA." He said, "That's what I tell everybody. I'm a secret agent. That way, they don't ask me to look at their teeth." And I thought, "Well, you know, if Sam Heifetz could say that he's a secret agent, maybe I can." So I went from barely being able to talk about it to eventually writing a book. And in the process, I got a call one day saying, "Well, you know, we in the CIA can't talk about Chile, but they're going to release all the documents. It'd be nice if somebody out there, would you mind if someone was a Washington Post interviewed?" I said, "No, I'm going to serve my country." Well, that was like the first big jump into the public arena. And then I became, little by little, seized with the thought that Americans don't understand there's not a good understanding of the CIA, and particularly on the action part, not the spying, but the Chile experience, the Iran experience, Afghanistan experience, hunting after narcotics. So I thought, you know, there's so much of what I did was in the public domain, unlike what agent did you run late at night. Mm. So Good Hunting is about the action part. You have the spying part, and then you have the action part. And I was able to write it, and it has to go through the CIA, not for whether they like what I'm saying, but whether there's any classified information in it. And I titled it, and it took me 3 years to come up with a title, I'd point out, with some idea of my IQ, but it's good hunting. And it's the expression, it goes back to the 1880s in British lore, and I think Kipling used it at a certain point. And it's, instead of break a leg in show business or tally-ho in the hunt, it's CIA people and their predecessor organizations, when someone goes out on a mission, hunt for bin Laden, it's good hunting. And I think it captures the business. Part of it is really going out there and hunting for information, or today it's hunting for terrorists and for hunting for bad people that want to do damage to our country, either in cyber or somewhere else. So the book is about the action part. The second, the one I'm working on now, not to tip it off, because I don't want my fellow CIA people start typing tonight and trying to get out ahead of me. It's about the intelligence part. And I think there's a lot of material that I think it'd be good for Americans to know about the realities of spy cases. So I'm working on that. So it'll be the two major disciplines, good hunting and yet to be titled, because I don't want to give up the title just yet, will be about the other aspect of working in the dark and meeting agents.
That's great. We got to get you back on when that comes out. I got to ask you about this. So you were just saying how early on, no one ever came out and said that they were former CIA and wrote books, and it's like a relatively new phenomenon. Interesting thing I have to ask you about, and I think Jason could kind of relate to this, is every now and again, there'll be a guy who comes out and says he's a Navy SEAL or, you know, former Marine, and they get outed. With the CIA, it's a little different, and there's been quite a few cases of people going on Fox News, for example, and saying that they were former CIA. I mean, the one that sticks out in my mind is Wayne Simmons. Wayne Simmons was regularly on Fox News saying that he was a former CIA analyst, I believe. Jack Murphy, our editor-in-chief, early on, way before this guy went to trial, said to me personally, he was like, I am positive, dude, this guy was never in the CIA. Sure enough, about 2 years later, it comes out that his entire story was bullshit. But unlike when a Navy SEAL comes out there or an Army Ranger comes out there, you're not going to get outed in public because the CIA is not going to come out and say this guy wasn't in the CIA. And the crazy thing with Simmons was that he was one of the people who advised the Iraq War. He had a quote from Donald Rumsfeld in the book. So, you know, it wasn't so strange that Fox News vouched for this guy and said, oh, yeah, it's former CIA. What's your feeling on these type of guys? Because he wasn't the only one.
I think the media is terribly negligent, and they're under tremendous pressure because they have to be on 24-7.
Yep, so there's exactly.
Tremendous pressure. I was watching one the other day, and I want to pick on anybody, but it doesn't even say CIA. It says he was trained by CIA. Like, that meant he might have gone out there for a 3-week course or went for a seminar. And yet what they're doing is saying, this fellow, you should listen to him because he received some unquantified, unqualified training at CIA. So they have some amazing spokesmen on. Some that were very junior, I'll go back and say junior lieutenant, and they're talking as if they were the director of CIA, and, you know, the president ought to do this, they ought to do that. And you sit there, where do people, there's a good New York word, Yiddish word, it's like chutzpah, you know, where do you get off doing this? No shame. And I went and watched Simmons tapes. And there he is talking convincingly. I mean, I think he actually believes in his own mind. He talks himself into it. Eventually he was arrested and convicted of fraud in a real estate deal. But he was on Fox, I think, 40-some times, multiple times. And I think there's an obligation. We're seeing more of this in the news. I mean, some big stories recently in the print paper, print as well, where they're not vetting, you know, they're not vetting their sources. So the problem is the real CIA people, most of them leave undercover and they can't say a word. Mm. And the other group really doesn't want to be out there as a talking head. Now, I go on, but part of my, not that I'm totally unique, but so much of what I did became public and I'm public. And I'm easy to vet. I mean, you just click it and you can figure out, first of all, the book, you can't have to have it vetted. But the point is, I think they're just under so much pressure. And even after they got burned, I'm not sure what they're doing anymore. And years ago, I warned a couple of the major networks. I said, "Look, do you know what you're doing?" And you know, it was the shrug of the shoulders, and on they went. The pressures of the job, but I think it's a big disservice. But when someone, you know, starts talking about policy and so on, I mean, chances are they were nowhere near it, because at the policy level, you are a public figure and you should be able to Google them, you know. So I'm stunned by it and annoyed. I tend, I have a much lower tolerance nowadays. I mean, I find myself switching between channels and trying to find a station where it's apolitical. Just go back to giving me the facts. Give me the facts. Don't the spin part and the yelling at each other. So it's all very intellectually dumbing down.
Yeah, it's true. We try not to do that here. That's like
no,
the
clearly
of
not.
Podcast.
No, they take our interview. Who could accuse us of that?
So I have a question. You know, we spoke about the politicization of government agencies. How do you feel about the accusations on the Mueller special counsel as far as them being more biased or heavy on the liberal side?
Yeah, I must say.
Now, what do you feel about the council itself?
You know, that's crazy. I think we might have been better served if we had taken some federal judge that was not a political appointee. I think there was a rush there, name, and I think it looks, it just has, there's too much political atmospherics around now. I'm afraid that Mueller's investigation will be, its credibility will be damaged, and then I think it's going to, where is it going to leave us? My newsletter, by the way, before from the very beginning, I really doubt that much is going to come from this, the collusion. I don't see it. I don't hear it. I think, and I've been saying this all along, you're going to get some people nailed, but they're going to be nailed for what we would call a Catholic, a venial sin, you know, and you'll get Flynn, and they'll get some... penalty of some sort. But we've spent all this time, and the big picture is what's happening to our relationship with Russia, what's happening to ourselves and how we deal with each other inside the Congress and the White House. And it's, really, what are we doing here? So I think it's going to be far less productive, and it's so politicized. And I think everybody, it's a tar baby. Everybody is getting tar on them. I think Mueller comes out somehow tarnished. Every person drug in around them is tarnished. Nobody. I'm trying to find somebody that looks good in the process. So if I thought there was something meaningful that would come out of it, but I'm having trouble finding that. So I wish they would gotten this done quickly before what I now see is the next several months. I think we're going to see a continuing slide in credibility, and I'm not sure that's good. I don't know where that leaves you at the end of the day, other than everybody bickering.
Last thing I want to ask you about, you're currently working at the Arkin Group, which you are the founding partner in. What work are you doing there for people interested?
Well, when we first started, Stanley Arkin and myself, he's a prominent lawyer in New York, he felt that a number of his clients needed the type of information that we talked about earlier, objective, you know, spin, and about, it's basically two things, information about people and about companies. And it's relatively easy, relatively is the operative word, to get information about people in the United States and corporations if you're doing business. But if you're going to do business halfway around the world, you know, in the Middle East, in Egypt or China or Russia, I mean, there are not many platforms. You can't count. There's no database system. So you really need the old-fashioned human sources. So I've built a career over the past 15 years, identifying a network of people. And we're like a general contractor. And we have this, I hope I'm not overstating, but I feel it's a wonderful network of people that are really good collectors, former intelligence people from different services and newspaper people and lawyers. I mean, there's a whole world out there. And it's one of the things in the government that I felt I missed. I hate to admit this, but there's a world out there that collects information. They don't consider it intelligence. It's considered they need the information to go do a deal. Mm-hmm. So there's a rich hunting ground out there. And what I've tried to do is capitalize on that and give to the private sector, equity groups, banks, individuals, information about countries, but more importantly, more granular information about specific people and specific companies and the problems they're going to encounter in those countries. So I've made a nice little business out of it, and it feels like old home, other than the Justice Department doesn't allow me to do anything that's untowards.
Mm-hmm. It's awesome. Well, hey, we really appreciate you coming on. You could visit the Arkin Group at thearkingroup.com. Pick up Jack's latest book, Good Hunting, An American Spymaster Story. You could also follow Jack on Twitter, at @JackDevine_TAG. I really have to say we appreciate you giving an hour of your time here, letting us pick your brain. It's been a real honor, and we'd love to have you come back on, hopefully in studio, since we're both here in New York.
Well, I would love to do that, and it's an honor to be able to talk to the caliber of audience you have and the so many people serving our country and now and in the past, and it's an honor to be able to share some time with them and to impart a view of how the intelligence world operates and to sort of demystify some of it, because I think our citizens deserve to understand it better and not just rely on Hollywood. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you once again, Jack, for your insight on a lot of these topics that we covered. Appreciate it. And I'm sure when you come back, hopefully it'll be Jack Murphy. Oh, man, be prepared for him because he's going to have a ton of questions
for
you.
He's just one more Irishman, I can say that.
We appreciate it. And this will be up tomorrow. Thanks so much. And really appreciate you going the full hour with us.
Okay, it was great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Dude, I can't believe that he went the full hour with us. That was awesome. Yeah. I would gladly go another hour with him if he comes back on with us. It sounds like he will.
I just feel like it was just a wide array of topics that he can speak on, you know, elaborately.
Yeah.
Because, and like he said, you know, and I thought it was interesting that, you know, he the way he worded it was that he is out in the open now because fortunately for him, a lot of the situations he's been involved in, a lot of the milestones within the CIA that have been publicized, he was a part of, he's able to talk about it now. So that's interesting. That's crazy.
Dude, this is the beauty of this podcast to me. Like, this was a home run interview. And I am going to talk some shit about the mainstream media. Like, who would you rather hear talk about these topics for an hour? Jack Devine, who is a true expert, who has been there and done that, or do you want to hear Tommy Lahren? You know, like
24-year-old
dude. It's so ridiculous. And like, this is what—that's what you get when you turn on the mainstream media. And I know I'm going to get shit. You know, it's right wing and left wing. Like, there's a lot of these people who have done absolutely nothing. And they're speaking like they're experts. I'll tell you the prime example. I remember watching one of those Hannity panels. And look, I know like a lot of this audience loves Hannity. I've never met Sean Hannity, but just the panel itself, right? There was a panel. It was a bunch of lawyers. It was a bunch of talking heads. And there was Nick Irving up there, all right? And they're asking questions about ISIS and blah, blah, blah. And all these talking heads who honestly don't know shit are the ones running their mouth. And like, I'm like, go to Nick Irving. Nick Irving has been there and done that. I want to hear his take on this. I don't care about some lawyer. And so, you know, that's the beauty of this podcast. Like, we let a guy like Jack Devine go an hour with us and really give some insight. So I can't speak more highly of having
it. Super intriguing how he can have an entire career after the CIA in somewhat of this similar environment. Like, he's doing intelligence gathering and collecting for corporations. That's crazy. It's the same thing that Steve does, you know,
yeah, to a certain extent. Ralston.
Yeah, and I worked with him on a ground level. But to think that is something necessary for corporations, what the hell are you guys doing? It's crazy, but it makes sense. I mean, you have these entire economies that, you know, live and die by your intelligence, especially, you know, information as to, you know, what country is up and coming, where should you open up a new bank or something. I mean, now that he said that, I'm thinking about it, and man, that's it's got to be a lucrative business.
I had to ask him about that phony CIA thing because it really is true. You know, like if you were watching Fox and you see some guy come out and say, I'm a MARSOC instructor, you'll be out there in the public saying this guy's full of shit. And the CIA, it's definitely a different scenario.
Yeah, definitely, bro.
So you don't actually know this. I've talked about it on the podcast with Jack, and this is like throwing myself under the bus here. I actually knew Wayne Simmons, and like I had contact. If you look at my cell phone, I have Wayne's number in here.
Did he work at any capacity for the CIA?
No, he was in the Navy. Was he a contractor? No, he was in the Navy for a very short period of time.
Was he Naval Intelligence at least?
No, he didn't do much at all. He was in the Navy for a very short period of time. But here's the crazy thing, is he legitimately was an advisor on the war in Iraq because he was able to bullshit his way up to the top. When you have a blurb on your book written by Donald Rumsfeld saying that you're legit, you've been there, done that, people are going
to
take
you
seriously.
They have a tendency to say, yeah, maybe there's some credibility to this, especially someone like Donald Rumsfeld.
So I booked Wayne. When I was working for David Webb's show, I've booked Wayne Simmons, and I was told he was legit. I'm not able to vet if someone was in the CIA or not, you know, and it's the same at Fox. Like, I don't hold them responsible. You know, it would be great if they had someone there like a Jack Murphy who could vet these guys, but I will give Jack credit. Years before he came out, told me, he was like, dude, don't book this guy. Don't have him on our show. He was not in the CIA. Sure enough, it comes out. Like, and it's just so crazy to think that there's other guys out there, because Jack's written about them. There's other guys out there who have written books who said, I did all these secretive black ops, and it turns out they didn't do shit.
Holy crap, and they have, like, flourishing careers. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting stuff. Man, loved having this guy on. I'm really looking forward to having him back. Before we get out of here, as a reminder for all of those who are listening, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to SoftRep TV, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. SoftRep TV's premier show, Training Cell, follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to SoftRep TV at softreptv.us and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership, only $4.99 a month. And if you haven't gotten a chance to check out the SoftRep Crate Club, you're definitely going to want to do that ASAP. It's a subscription to get a box of badass tactical gear and survival gear delivered to your door every month. Here's the kicker. All of the gear is handpicked and tested by former special ops guys, so you know you're getting quality gear that's going to work when you need it to. Crates we've sent in the past have included gear like custom knives, multi-tools, fire starters, EDC med kits, and other kick-ass stuff. You don't just get great gear with your subscription, you're also supporting a veteran-owned and run company. To subscribe and start getting your gear, visit crateclub.us. We also have gift options available. That's crateclub.us. And I should throw out there that we're getting the finishing touches on the Vegas party, the team room party. I'll let you guys know the details as soon as I do. I know it's later than usual. This is just how it worked out. But if you're in the area, we'd love to see you there. Earlier I did a Power of Thought with Brandon Webb and Steve Ralston. And Brandon was talking about the team room event we did with Jim West. And I didn't know about Jim taking a pocket knife out of some guy's pocket.
My pocket.
And having it up. It was you?
Yeah.
He told me it was some guy there, and he took it out of his pocket and had it like up to his throat within seconds.
Yeah, we were, he was demonstrating like, I don't know, entry techniques while you're at the bar or whatever. And, you know, he's coming in and he's like, you know, hitting me or whatever, you know, blocking and all that stuff. And then, you know, he kind of like glanced down and saw my pocket knife in my pocket. I'm posing for him.
It was you.
Yeah, I'm posing for him to do whatever it is he's going to do. And next thing you know, it just like whoop, and like, quick second he pulled it out of my pocket, spun me around, and like put it to my throat. But he didn't open it or nothing. He just, you know, held the handle to my throat. He goes, "Hey man, be careful where you keep your gear."
Do like, you think that would have happened? That would have went down like that, I mean, in real life?
Like I said, we were demonstrating a specific move, so I wasn't even thinking about it. You know, it's not something. Yeah. You know, whatever. Here, do the arm bar on me or whatever you got to do. But, you know, whatever it was.
Jim is amazing.
Yeah, but it's something that I never thought about. And I was like, you know what? If I do get into a scuffle with somebody, this is kind of out there in the open for them to just take off of my pocket, take out of my pocket, because it's clipped into the inside of my pocket. And anyone who knows enough who know that's a knife, and they could just two fingers pull it out, you know.
Jim knows weapons though, like no other. Yeah. Like when I see how fast he moves,
he's pretty quick.
Yeah,
he's fucking fast, man.
Yeah, and it's unsuspecting. You know, if someone saw him in the street, they'd be like, "Oh, it's an older guy."
Oh no, he'll tear him up. He'll tear him up in a heartbeat. Like he's quick. I think it's just that the conditioned response that he has already that. I don't even think he even realizes what he's going to do at the moment. He's that fast. Like, he'll just react to an action.
Yeah. Hey, so we appreciate you guys checking out this show. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps. I think we're currently number 4 in the category. And when I last checked, let's get us back up to number 1. We need those reviews. So please leave a review. You could follow Jason on Instagram at jdelgatoarte. On Twitter, right at Bounty Hunter JD.
Yes.
Do I have it right?
Yes, sir.
You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at... Oh, no. I'm just on Twitter. I'm losing my mind here. You can follow me on Twitter at Ian Scotto. I don't have an Instagram. You can follow the show, of course, on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio. Next episode, Liz Carmouche.
Nice. That's going to be a nice one.
Dude, that's going to be great. I mean, she fought in the first ever women's UFC bout against Ronda Rousey. And there's just a lot of history there. I'm really excited to have her on. And I guess that wraps it up.
Hey, thanks for listening to us, guys.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. For all of the great content from our veteran journalists, join us and become a Team Room member today at softrep.com. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio. And be sure to also check out the Power of Thought podcast, hosted by Hurricane Group CEO and Navy SEAL sniper instructor, Brandon Webb.